And there they are, the familiar strains of the Tom Tom Club, Tina Weymouth and her gorgeous sisters, out front of the band called the Tom Tom Club, and the Wordy Rapping Hood is the show that you have stumbled across here on the Voice of the Peninsula, RPP FM. Tracy Hutchison is my name, and the premise of this show is to profile in delicious and gentle conversation the many folk who call the peninsula home. And this week we've got the big cheese, I have to say. I've been bracing myself. The big cheese at RPPFM is Brendan Telfer. He's one of the blokes you can trust on Monday morning breakfast. He's a voice that you hear in many of the station announcements. And he's a man that we have something of a shared experience or history at the ABC radio in past lives. But I'm pleased to introduce the station manager of RPPFM, lifetime member of the community.
I am. Tracy, thank you. Yeah, that was a bit of a shock in an AGM a few years ago. But Tracy, it's an equal delight to be sitting across a microphone from you. I mean, we did pass through the ABC and we had a number of commonalities there, but here we are down here on the beautiful Mornington Peninsula, isn't it? It's just wonderful. And yeah, this is a bit unusual being interviewed. I prefer to take a back
seat. I know.
God love me, but here I am. You teased me out.
You've tried very hard to keep a low profile, but I've strong-armed you into the studio for this June 10 edition of the Wordy Rapping Hood. I think I'm up to about episode 8.
Isn't it amazing?
And we're rocking along.
And the wonderful people that are calling the Mornington Peninsula home. They're just some incredible people. And the conversations that you're having have been fantastic, and I'm sure more to come as well.
Series. It's a great showcase. So the first question, Brendan Telfer, on this program is always, what brought you to the peninsula?
Well, my mum and dad had been down here for many years. My parents had been down here for many years. And so although I wasn't a regular resident in those days, I'd sort of moved on a little bit. There was a reference point to the peninsula. And then when we had a chance to buy a property here in the 1990s, we did it. At that stage, I was sort of travelling internationally as well a lot. And it was a good starting point for us, and a good solid base, I think, for the family that was just sort of burgeoning at that stage. But, you know, it's got everything. It absolutely has got everything. It's near the water. It's got clean air. And I used to remember sort of schlepping up and down to the city and coming out on a Friday night. And that drive up Oliver's Hill, having put in a huge week in those days, the ABC, there was nothing better than just coming up Oliver's Hill and all of a sudden you just wind down the windows, suck in that fresh air, getting up over the top and you're home. And for two glorious days, you can mooch around, you know, you can go and do the markets or whatever you want to do, or just hang out, walk down to the beach. I mean, it's got everything, absolutely everything. It is drop-dead gorgeous and I absolutely love it.
Let's just settle in now to the life and times of Brendan Telfer in the 50 minutes that we've got of this program today. And so we know what brought you here, but in and around all of that, there's been quite a life that's been very international in its flavour.
Yep.
And I guess you were born in Melbourne, but you took off and you did the thing that a lot of people did in those days.
Indeed.
And went to London.
But again, it was my crazy parents who were from that sort of pre-hippie period, that sort of beatniky hippie period, that wanted us to have this international education. And so we ended up travelling through most of the 60s and 70s when I eventually got back to Australia to go to university in Perth, which I'd seen on my way out of Australia on one of those occasions. I thought, wow, this is fantastic. If I ever have an opportunity, I'm going to come back here and study or work or do something. I just love Perth, the azure blue and that Indian Ocean thing. And I just thought, wow, that looked fantastic. But yeah, so they dragged us off. And so, you know, we ended up living at one stage in England. Then we lived in Africa.
Tell me about that.
That was just before the end of the Selassie regime. So I'm going to an international school in Addis Ababa and meeting an incredible cross-section of people. And it's probably provoked my great interest in people and personalities. And then they ended up back in Germany, where I stayed for a while. By this stage, they decided that I should go down and finish off my education in England, which I did.
So you said they had the kind of a hippie thing, but there was obviously, what was the work? What was driving?
Well, my old man was a journalist and a broadcaster, and he wanted to test himself out as well in the big smoke. And so he was working for a series of international broadcasters around the world, including the Beeb and all that sort of stuff. Ended up at Deutsche Welle in Cologne, Bonn, doing that sort of stuff. So I'm keeping a bit of an eye on this, but all the time I'm formulating an idea, well, I'm not sure about broadcasting. I'm not sure about journalism. I think I want to do something like the Department of Foreign Affairs. And so I was going that way, and that's why I added German into my degree in Perth, thinking that I was going to end up in Canberra, probably doing the Department of Foreign Affairs and doing the job for Aussie around the world. But as it turned out, you know, the old man said, you know, why don't you have a crack at the ABC? They're always looking for a few punters, and in those days they were. And that's how it started. And by the early 80s, mid-80s, I'm working at the ABC. But I recalled some extraordinary experiences that we were having in Europe, amazing experiences. So I was going to school, hooking up with some mates of mine by this stage that were living in Paris and Germany. These are French friends and German friends. And we were doing atrocious things like hitchhiking down to Spain, getting on an old ferry in Barcelona, and then spending a summer in the Balearic Islands on a smaller island just off of Ibiza, which had not at this stage turned into the Ibiza that it is today. It was just basically a wayward destination for some travellers. But Formentera was another ferry ride away, where I spent most of my summers with these crazy kids. And we would go down there and drink cheap Spanish wine and live on the local bread and smoke gitanes and gouas and all those sorts of crazy things that you did at that stage in the sort of 70s. And then we'd all head back to Paris for a week, have a week in Paris before we all took off, by this time September, of course, back to school in the UK, then back to their whatever they were doing in Germany and all. So I was having this sort of international thing happening. But all the time thinking, I'm an Aussie, I'm going to head back to Aussie.
So you're schooling in London in the 70s.
Yes.
So that must have been, so we're talking about the advent of punk, we're talking about everything up for grabs.
Indeed that, and we'd been through, you know, I was lucky, I think, because I'd seen the sort of tail end of a renaissance as well, this extraordinary expression of pop culture, and London was the epicentre of the world.
Absolutely.
I'd been around and had a reference point with the Beatles, Sgt. Peps, and you know, the Rolling Stones were my thing at that stage as well, and the Beatles and everybody else. There was this reference point, and there was the political turmoil that, you know, we used to talk about at infinitum, these beautiful dinners in Paris about the revolution back in the 60s and the student uprisings and the anarchists and all this sort of stuff. And so we were out there. And
As a formative experience, I mean, this is kind of wildly colourful and dynamic recollections of a young man finding his way in the world. What do you think, when you sort of reflect on what that experience did for you in terms of shaping your view of the world and your place in it? What did it deliver you?
It turned me into an internationalist straight away. And I didn't realise that until I came back to Australia, because I'm always harbouring this notion that I'm an Aussie. And I get back to Australia and I think, well, hang on, something's happened. Something seriously has happened. And those poems really got stuck into me, or that European experience really got stuck into me. And so I could then empathise to a large extent about the people that were calling Australia home and what they were leaving behind as well. So I had some sort of empathy and some sort of understanding of that sense of distance and lost to a degree, but at the same time, some really wonderful recollections. Africa, I mean, what a continent. And for a kid mooching around, I mean, we used to sort of drive out of Addis in those days when it was still relatively safe with the folks, and go down and with these American families and stuff, and we used to go down and we used to holiday at a place called Lake Lungana, which is outside of Addis Ababa. We used to set up these camps down there for freaking weeks and just listen to the hyenas roaring in the background and look at the amazing African stars with the big bushfires. So it was just amazing, amazing experiences.
What were the politics of the time in Africa?
Well, the politics were that we had this sort of dictator emperor, Selassie, who was in the last throes. And, of course, we were about to have a major famine in that part of the world as well, which would cause major political ructions for him. But in those days, he was still at the height. I mean, there was a hotel over there called the Gion, and you know, rumour had it that you could see Selassie through the pool where we used to go and swim as kids with his trained cheetahs, which were on silver leashes, that he used to walk around through the gardens next door. Never saw it myself, but so it's told to me. But look, it was an amazing, and Africa is such an incredible, colourful, bold, and inspiring continent. It was amazing, and I've loved it ever since.
Mm. So you were mid-teens?
Yeah, coming back to Oz, and so then was time to get serious about education, and would I do that in England and go to university over there, or would I reintroduce myself to Australia and come back to Oz? And I decided to come back to Oz and Perth, which I'd seen on my way out. And so it was UWA for the next few years in the late 70s.
So I'm just trying to imagine what that transition was like, going from London, which was very much an absolute epicentre culturally, socially,
correct,
politically, a lot going on.
But there was a lot, you see, but then again, there was that sort of retiring sort of English reserve thing as well, which was the English education system. And to come out and confront at that stage as well via Sydney into Melbourne, this Australian sort of beach culture, this sense of confidence that my Australian peers had at that stage. They were driving cars, for goodness sakes. I mean, that was something that we Europeans didn't really think about. They were thinking about property and stuff like this, stuff that just wasn't in our lexicon. But they were doing it, and there was a certain brashness and a certain confidence about Australia that I really sort of admired to some degree. But I realised also that there'd been a substantial change in the 18 or 20 years that I'd been, or whatever it was, away.
Been away. Let's stay in London just for a moment, because you talked about the music that you were experiencing and being around, being in England during that time, discovering yourself, formative years, and you very much were a Beatles and Stones child. Did you make a choice?
No, I didn't. I admired them both equally. Sgt. Pepper's at that stage I grew into very much as well. But the Stones certainly had a sort of bravado that I quite admired, and a sort of in-your-face thing that I just thought, I like that.
Certainly the spirit of the 70s.
Yeah.
Alive and well in the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, the dear old Stones.
Did you see them?
I did. I saw them when they came back out here to Aussie, and saw them a couple of times here. Saw them over in South Australia one time. I've been tempted to go and see them in their more recent incarnations, but I'm thinking, I did that with Taj Mahal the other day. Dear old Taj, who had been a little bit of a blues theme in my life as well. And God love me, I went up to see Taj with my beautiful wife the other week, and he was here, and he'd done the Byron blues thing. And I saw him, and I had to ask the usherette, were we in the right place? Because they're all these very old people, and they look beautiful, but they just look so old. I thought, really? And then dear old Taj comes out, and he can barely get his guitar, his beautiful dobro. And I remember him, you know, from the 70s, 80s, when he was 6'6", and he was in his white suit with his huge big Stetson and his beautiful golden dobro, and everybody was in love with Taj. And just to see him the other day as this lovely, portly old grandfather, and us and me in the crowd, and I suddenly realised, my goodness, I'm as old as these people. And they were all beautiful as well 30, 40 years ago. Anyway.
24 minutes past 12, RPP FM, the voice of the peninsula. The Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. Tracy Hutchison here with you as your host and our guest on our Wordy Rapping Hood show today. The Big Cheese here at RPP FM, station manager Brendan Telfer, and the life and times of BT. And we've kind of done the trip, the formative years.
The pubescent stuff.
The formative years that sound like they were formative indeed, and brought you back to Perth, and eventually crossed the Nullarbor back to Melbourne.
Yeah, which was a great sort of another semi-tragedy in my life, because I'd seen Perth, loved it. It was just an incredible city to study in. You know, just a couple of pairs of jeans, the beautiful Indian Ocean, lived a block away from beautiful UWA, totally indulged the student body, everything. It was so rich, it was affluent, it was riding a huge boom. And that was the thing. They just didn't have the depth in the job market. And so I had to come back east. And I was still thinking about Department of Foreign Affairs at that stage, but then just ended up as a casual working in at Radio Australia. And
for those that are unfamiliar with what was Radio Australia, it was the ABC's international radio arm,
yep,
and in its heyday in the 80s was just a massive part of the national broadcaster's presence internationally.
It was, and it was projecting an amazing image of Australia. It truly was an incredible institution, and unfortunately through a series of, I'm not sure whether well thought out moves, it basically ended up giving it all away. But in the time when I got there, so I was helping out in the sports department, and so one summer in the early 80s, we organised, just to give you a sense of how powerful it was, I got the Australian and the Indian cricketers that year to sign a cricket bat. It might have been Pakistan, I can't quite remember now, but they all did. And so we chucked it out there and we just said, anybody in the subcontinent, just write in. And literally within the next weeks, we literally had bagloads of entries to win this signed cricket bat. Mm. That was the power of it. I mean, it was just an incredible institution. And the ABC, in its wisdom, by the late 80s, had given the whole thing away. They just literally shut it down. They didn't transition it. They didn't turn it into... And now everybody, of course, is beating a path to India. It's the next big thing. And here, the ABC and the Australian government had this incredible opportunity to turn around this amazing goodwill at that level and really work it. They never did. They gave it away. And they were to do exactly the same thing in the Pacific, only much more recently, which again is one of the great tragedies, and somebody really should absolutely stand up and take responsibility for that as well. But that's a little bit later in the story, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess the final chapter around Radio Australia and the Australian Network came to a sort of a screaming end in 2014, indeed, about 2 years ago now, when the Abbott government decided to pull the pin on that particular service. But talk a little bit more about, I guess, the interesting stuff about your role as a broadcaster and as a sportscaster particularly, and those relationships, I guess, that were built, you know, in the purest sense, when sport and radio and media can actually really be such a uniting force, which was the heyday of RA.
It was, and I was very lucky to be in it. And so I was asked then to get involved and to start sort of working out a few ideas. And we had management that was obviously very keen to develop the whole sports thing. And so came up with a couple of propositions which they liked. So we worked very heavily to build and identify a need, and there was needs-based broadcasting, basically, and getting conversations happening with our close neighbours, and it was through sport. And so then I was in this incredibly privileged position of representing Australia and going reporting on things like Olympic Games. My first, and I just couldn't believe it because I'm still a casual, I'm still just sort of mooching around the ABC, sort of trying to sort of ply my trade, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm on the top floor of the Bonaventure Hotel. We've got Carl Lewis running in the 100s. But what we were doing is we were sort of regionalizing our broadcasting. We were looking at specific athletes and performances of some of the developing countries. Mm. And this resonated with the IOC, who were trying to develop and spread the love of their sports and what they were doing in terms of development and empowerment of people. And so we were traveling along a very similar path, and that path would continue then for the next decade or so that I was at the ABC. IOC really endorsed what we were doing. They really loved it. And of course, all of a sudden, people in places like the Pacific and some parts of Asia were getting a voice and were getting attention, and their stories were being told. And they hadn't been told very well before, or they weren't told. It was great to be part of.
The power of sport as one of the great languages, it's sort of given, it's a very diverse, the Pacific is such a diverse linguistic set of countries,
yes,
linguistically and culturally. Sport is one of the great unifiers. In my own experience with RA, certainly told me how powerful and important sport is and what a universal language it is. Being part of that and seeing how what that relationship can be like, and I guess Australia's role and your own role in that. What was that like?
Yeah, I was very privileged to be in it. But also, I mean, it took me to some amazing places that I would never have seen. More recently up in Papua New Guinea, when we were working for international television up there, and we were doing the Pacific Games, which is basically the Pacific's
version of the Olympics
and or the Commonwealth Games, which now does include teams from Australia, because they're now getting to a point where all this development work has produced teams with enough depth that they can test themselves out at the very highest level, and they can take on the Aussies and they can take on the Kiwis. And this was the aspirational stuff that we were starting off in the mid-80s and early 90s when we started all this thing to try and canvas these ideas and give them expression, to the point where now these kids in weightlifting and other sports, sailing and stuff like that, and rugby, of course, is a no-brainer, where these guys are the equal of and probably superior to the Australian and New Zealand equivalent. So you're now getting kids from the Pacific that are getting Commonwealth gold medals, getting Olympic medals as well. The amazing story, of course, is Pye Wolfgram back in 1996 in Atlanta, and the great Muhammad Ali, God love him, who, of course, is being remembered this very weekend. I was there in 96 and saw the great man light the cauldron. And one of the most amazing personal experiences was seeing this incredible man, this huge champion, who in his great dignity and still in his great power was able to withstand the shaking hand as he lit that cauldron, and the noise of the shout of his name, Ali, resonating around that stadium in Atlanta was amazing. Absolutely incredible. But I was there really to follow a number at this stage of Pacific teams, and in particular one boxer, Pye Wolfgram, who came from a small island called Vavao in Tonga. Nobody knew Pye Wolfgram. I did. I'd seen him in Vanuatu 2 years earlier at the mini games, absolutely pummel anybody. And if anybody had a jab as good as Ali, it was Pye Wolfgram. He had the most amazing jab. It was incredible. And I'd just seen him decimate everybody. The Tongans took him away and they trained him up on the West Coast and they unleashed him in Atlanta. And this huge man, Mountain, who I'd seen, who was just massively overweight, this hugely obese Tongan, had slimmed down into this magnificent specimen that looked quite as good as Muhammad Ali. And he went all the way. And I was the only guy there in the mix zone in the first rounds that wanted a grab with Pye. Then all of a sudden, as this story started to unfold, the rest of the international press were coming up and asking me for details. Where was this guy? Who was he? Where did he come from? Why is he this good? Blah, blah, blah. All the way up to the gold medal showdown with Klitschko, Vladimir Klitschko, who was still world champ. And what's not known is that Pye Wolfgram got into the ring that day with a broken nose and a broken thumb, and the consequences of his earlier bouts. But he didn't want to tell the medical authorities that. He wanted to go and have a chance to represent his kingdom against the great Klitschko, which he did, and he fought beautifully. And considering that he had a broken thumb, left hand, which was his great jabbing hand, and a broken nose, was just incredible. And that he came back with a silver medal turned him, of course, into a superhero in Tonga. But it was just an incredible experience. But I always have a bit of a joke with dear old Pye that it was on the very night that I had to see him fight that the great Al Green was down at the House of Blues, when I'd been dying to see Al Green. And unfortunately, dear old Pye was fighting on the night that Al Green was performing. But it's very interesting. Pye Wolfgram, Vavao. It's where my great-grandmother comes from, incidentally. She comes from an island called Vavao, Limatua Village. And our great-grandfathers, his great-grandfather Wolfgram, had come across the United States on a wagon train, ended up jumping on a whaler and ending up in Vavao, marrying a local girl and creating a dynasty. The Wolfgram sisters, of course, are all related to this famous family.
The Wolfgram sisters, correct, who are fabulous singers.
Beautiful vocalists. Local singers. And indeed. And so my great-grandfather had come out from Ireland, jumped a ship, and ended up in the Pacific marrying a local girl called Manu Siu. And they were both contemporaries at that stage. And I just thought it was very, very weird that our great-grandfathers had this sort of contemporary knowledge of one another. Mm. And in fact, my great-grandfather had to incarcerate Wolfgram during the First World War because he was the honorary consul up there for the New Zealand government. And so he had to house arrest his own good buddy. But then many years later, of course, back in 1996, Pye Wolfgram and I are there in the mix zone at the Atlanta Olympic Games. He's got a silver medal around his neck, and I'm the sports jock there with the hot and sweaty microphone trying to get the story back out to the Pacific and the world.
Brendan Telfer is our guest on the Wordy Rapping Hood. RPPFM is the station. Brendan Telfer, station manager at RPPFM, and we're winding our way through the life and times of Brendan's story, as is the premise of this show, the Wordy Rapping Hood. And we're kind of centered in the Pacific. Your great love of the Pacific clearly was is familial as well as something that I guess you had a particular passion for. Do you think that there was something in the DNA?
Absolutely. There was something that happened to me. I don't know. I mean, my wife, who is Rarotongan, comes from the Cook Islands, laughs at me. She reckons I've got about as much Tongan blood as my small toe. But there is seriously something happens when I get out to the Pacific. There is something that resonates in the DNA. There's something goes off. So I truly do love the Pacific. There is something very, very special about it for me, and I do relate to it very much.
One more question about the Pacific, because you also ended up on Nauru for
yes.
a couple of years. So you did a big chunk of time at Radio Australia.
Took off.
Then went to Nauru. And now we know Nauru now as have a very fairly unfortunate association with Nauru as a place that we send people in to detention in Australia. What's the Nauru that you know?
Well, it was a completely different Nauru. And indeed, there's probably a slightly different story to tell about the Nauru, the here and now as well. And there are probably some alternates that you probably could hear, and we might at another time do that.
Mm.
But nevertheless, in those days, yes, they were investing in an international television network, which was based in Nauru, going up on satellite. And it was going to basically tell the story again of sport in the Pacific, Sports Pacific Network. And they asked if I'd like to join them, and I said, sure, I'd love to help them set it up. So did that for 2 years and had the most incredible time. And again, I was probably giving my kids by this stage the experiences that I'd had as a kid. They were going to the local international school because I thought it was such an important part and component of my upbringing that my parents had given me that I could show them what I had been experiencing at similar ages when they were very, very young. And I hope it's put them in good stead as well. But yeah, so that was Nauru. And then at the end of that, the ABC sort of got on the phone, called me back. Sydney was looming. They wanted me to come back and give them some assistance with Sydney. So I came back and started working for the ABC and again, Radio Australia from 2000 on.
Till 2010.
Yep.
What then is your version of contemporary Nauru, the Nauru that we don't hear about?
Basically, that it's not quite as austere as it is, that there's a lot more flexibility in and around our friends that are visiting from overseas, and that they're treated with great respect. And it's a better conversation than would be that you're hearing or seeing being reported here.
That time in the Pacific, which basically spans a couple of decades, you've been going in and out of the Pacific, working, and obviously with family connections as well. What, for me, when I was at RA broadcasting into the Pacific particularly, it gave me a very different sense of our place in the world. The Pacific is, for reasons that still elude me, is very much not considered part of our patch. And I still haven't quite worked out why we don't have a greater sense of being connected to the Pacific nations that are so close. What's your take on that in terms of Australia's role and the relationships and the power of those connections?
Yeah, I think it's probably a political administrative role. I think basically Australia and New Zealand probably in the early 1900s or mid-1900s decided to sort of divide the area up a little bit. The Aussies and the Kiwis said, okay, Kiwis, you go east, you take Polynesia, we'll take the Melanesian area and we'll look after that. The Kiwis do get the Pacific, but like you, I'm absolutely amazed that Australians don't spend more time in the Pacific or get to know it.
Mm.
You know, Samoa and all those sorts of amazing destinations, the Tonga group, the Northern Tonga group, Vavau, where my great-grandmother comes from, it is drop-dead gorgeous.
Mm.
Savai'i in Samoa, you know, the outer islands of the Hawaiian group. I mean, I just don't understand. I mean, I can understand the allure and the beauty and the deluxe value of things like Phuket and Asia and stuff like that, and it's fabulous. But there's a whole other story that is the Pacific, and it's just waiting there, all the way up into Micronesia, to Guam, Palau. I mean, these incredible places, FSM, Marshall Islands, they're just incredible, just waiting to be discovered and understood by Australia, I think. But again, you know, and I think, again, the Australian government probably bears some responsibility here in terms of knocking over things like ABC International and just absolutely switching it off. It's just...
But I think
defies logic.
There's also been a very patronising kind of view, I think, of Australia's role in the Pacific, that that we are the kind of
the big guys,
we're the people that knows best for others in our region. Yeah. Did you get a sense that that's how perceived in the Pacific?
Perhaps I think that's maybe a more historical version. I think now it's a more even conversation, and I think Australia is getting the fact that there's some very important and some very wise thoughts and thinking going on out there about development and issues and how best to tap into what Australia's got to offer and the relationship between Australia and those people out there as well.
Mm. The other thing, the other factor that is coming in the more contemporary version of that story also is the partnerships that China is looking to develop into the Pacific and in partnership with the New Zealand government and through a number of the smaller Pacific nations and looking at those very strategic and powerful partnerships that we don't hear very much about in Australia.
But we should be very mindful of, because China is investing huge amounts of money all the way across the Pacific, from Rarotonga all the way across up into Micronesia. It is huge because they see it as a very important resource. And we've seen basically as an annexation, if you will, of some of the islands already on the southeastern coast of China. I don't think that's necessarily going to be an ongoing trend, but spheres of influence and also the Chinese Navy, which is being invested in big time. Australia has really got to keep its eye on what is happening in the Pacific. And again, it speaks to the reason why I have no idea they did what they did when they switched the ABC off and you had this extraordinary ability to talk directly to the people across the Pacific 24/7 and you killed it dead. I have no idea why that happened.
Brendan Telfer is our guest on The Wordy Rapping Hood here on RPP FM, also the station manager at RPP, the big cheese, but someone who spent a huge part of his professional working life very invested in Pacific broadcasting. Let's just do this on RPP FM. Pate Pate. Why did you pick this one?
It just conjures up. I think it came out in about 1999. It's the combo from across the Pacific. It's the rhythms, it's the sounds, it's the remix. And again, it's just showing you just how clever and skillful and creative the Pacific can be. It's a beautiful piece of music, and it just sort of summarizes, I guess, a decade at that particular time.
This week, the big cheese at RPPFM, the station manager, Brendan Telfer, and we've spent a lot of time, Brendan, talking about your life and times, your formative years, your times as an internationalist, your time in the Pacific, and in more recent years, now your time that we know and love you here on the peninsula, especially here at RPP as the station manager, and you've been absolutely integral to setting up the new studio space here in what folk would know as the old grounds of the Mornington High School and very much kind of putting the station on a brand new course. This must have been a really lovely homecoming in lots of ways. You talked about at the beginning of our chat, schlepping up and down from home down here up to town to work at the national broadcaster, coming back, taking that big breath on a Friday night that we many of us know when you think, that's it for the week, I've got a couple of days. But being able to live and work on the peninsula now and in broadcasting is kind of basically ticking pretty much all the boxes.
Absolutely, it's fantastic. And I don't want to take credit for anything really, because it comes down to the team. I mean, it's just an incredible team that we have here, Tracy. And I might have also mentioned at the outset just how talented the people are down here on the Mornington Peninsula, a little like yourself maybe, but others that have just, they've done it. They've come to a point in their lives where they could probably see out. They could do more up in town, but they're making some real value judgments about what it is that they want out of their lives. And they look out the window down here on the Mornington Peninsula and see the view, see the trees, see the rainstorms, or see the beautiful sunny days. And they think this is very, very important. And it's all about that lifestyle. And that's one of the great motivators for me, was that I just thought that the radio station needed to reflect that very important conversation, if you will, that we probably all have and we need to have. We need a strong voice here on the Mornington Peninsula. It's a critical time, I think, in terms of where and how the peninsula develops from here. And I just felt that it was If I could assist in some way in getting that conversation happening, it was time to do it. There are big forces at play as well in the media, and we also had to get smart and get across some of those things. Otherwise, we were just going to become a little asterisk in history, and people in 10 years from now would say, oh, you remember the time that this place even used to have its own radio station? We can't get there. We're not allowed to get there. We have to get it moving, and the team that we've got here at RPPFM to move it into this next period is very, very important. At the AGM this last year, I just mentioned that we're now in the same space. Once upon a time, community, quote unquote, local radio was a space where you could bring in your eclectic mix of records and albums. And you can still do that, and we encourage that. But I think it has to be a little bit more, because we're in the same space as the big guys. We're competing for eyes and ears, just like SEN is, like AW is, like 774 is, like Channel 7 is. The distinctions, there's a blurring of the distinctions. We're in the same space. And as the bigger networks start to network up and down the eastern seaboard, as the ABC does start to further rationalise its news and programming, and likewise the AWs of this world as they get onto their digital national networks, it opens up an area that I think we should be in, and we should be engaging with our community. And as I said, the time was right. I could have reinvented myself, I suppose, in 2010, 2011, and gone on in the ABC, but I was getting a sense that all was not right, that there were going to be some federal decisions coming down the line that were probably going to impact that decision. And I just thought, you know what, if the ABC is getting some really strategic issues that wrong, I don't have a great deal of confidence going forward. I would much rather get involved with a group of people that want to do something, can do something, and are doing something, and that's us. And it is just a total pleasure and privilege to be here.
Brendan Telfer is our guest here on RPPFM, station manager at the radio station, and our guest on The Wordy Rapping Hood for this Friday. Brendan, you're talking there about pretty much everything being up for grabs in media terms now. We're seeing a wholesale overhaul of traditional media, of the way people are receiving their media, what platform they're receiving it on. And it's interesting, as the traditional forms of those, that message delivery, is becoming increasingly centralised around a kind of a news cycle and limited amounts of information sort of being controlled by limited numbers of people. Are you seeing this as a time where the people are looking more to a local source of, and that this is the time for, so localised news services like the Mornington Peninsula News, which is defying the odds as well as an independent newspaper and a news outlet, it's actually expanding, and community radio.
Correct, absolutely, and it's where, you know, where we can fill that space and where we have to, but we have to be on our game. We have to invest big time in terms of equipment and stuff like that to take it on with the big guys, and that takes a lot. There's a lot of pressure on us sort of commercially. We're having to operate a small business in that environment. But yes, the opportunities are huge. And for us here on the Mornington Peninsula as well, we're surrounded by water on three sides. You know, we know what we are. We can define ourselves very easily. And so from a marketing point of view, that's probably a little bit easier for us. We know exactly what we're up for. We know who we are. And it's an important time, a very, very important time. And indeed, you mentioned Mon Pen News. So we are sort of collaborators with Cam and the crew over there, and we are media partners.
It's certainly a very interesting time, and I guess that's the perspective that I'm seeing too, that I'm now involved in education. I'm teaching a whole new generation of people that want to be journalists and want to work in the media, and everything is up for grabs. It is all about identifying niche audiences, finding subscription models around what it is that you, what the product is that you're going to put into the market, and creating something that people do actually think, yeah, I will actually subscribe to that, or I will pay for that, because those models, all the old models, are very much changing.
Absolutely. It's exciting, a little bit frightening, but at the same time, we've got such incredible stories to tell down here on the Mornington Peninsula, and hopefully we're going to be able to do that and very powerfully going forward.
One final thing, this being home, and you've spoken a lot about it, but in the time then that you've even been living down here over sort of the, I guess it's how many old decades that you're for me, you've seen an enormous change. You know, what do you see as the most exciting thing that's on the horizon for the peninsula?
Basically, I think probably it's self-awareness and the fact that it can preserve and guard the qualities that are very, very important to us all, and that's quality of life, choice and options.
We've got choice for one last song, and you've given me a list of things. Can you give me one to go out?
Oh, well, I don't know. I was thinking we were going to wrap it up. Maybe what about Dear Old Moby? Because I'm a bit of a movie buff. Not a movie buff. I'm a bit of a fan of Dear Old Moby because he, of course, supplies the tail end out track to the Bourne series. Right. I don't know what responsibility or how this fits in, but dear old Jason Bourne is back next month, and I'm looking forward to seeing the fourth instalment in this series. So I've just figured, hey, go Moby.
Any opportunity to hear a little bit of Moby on RPPFM is good enough for me. 4 minutes to one, some news at one. Let's take it up to news time with this. This is Extreme Ways on RPPFM. That's a track from Moby. Extreme Ways is the name of it, and the final selection of this week's guest on the Wordy Rapping Hood, station manager here at RPPFM, Brendan Telfer.